and all right, how are you doing? Nearly forgot my catchphrase then. No, I'm only joking. How are you? All well? Welcome to another episode. This week, we're joined by Derek Ray. Derek is another of those breed of commentators that you'll know the voice before the name. More often than not, if you watch BT Sport, he has worked across a number of leagues, Serie A, Bundesliga, Premier League, Scottish football. A thoroughly nice man who joined me from live from America via Skype. And it was great to chat to him. His memory is incredible. He picked up an England-Scotland Rouse Cup game in 1986 at the tender age of 19, when he was still an Aberdeen University student. And he just wanders on into Wembley with the great Mike Ingham and just does one of the biggest games of any commentator's career at the age of 19. He's subsequently done plenty more, which is his moment. It goes on and talks about the whole spectacle of the 2005 Champions League final, which was won by some team. As you know, anyway, you know, I'm not joking before you all get angry. I hope you really enjoy. It was a cracking chat, and Derek is one of those people that you think is a lovely, lovely fella, and it turns out you're absolutely correct. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. Take care. Enjoy. Bye-bye.
Well, the first memory for me really goes back to 1986, and I was 19 years of age at the time. And it's sort of two football events in one, really, when you look back at what happened to me personally in the spring of 1986. I was a student at the University of Aberdeen, and I'd started to do bits and pieces for BBC Scotland. And this really was my ambition. I was a German student, absolutely loved German language, still do. But the ultimate goal was to be a football commentator. And I'd been doing it for hospital radio in Aberdeen for quite a few years. I'd been making tapes of myself for more than a decade, going back to when I was about 7 years of age. So you can tell I was pretty driven, pretty obsessed. And here I was, student at Aberdeen University, who had started out with BBC Scotland doing some reports. And I got a call on a Friday from a guy called Charles Runcie, who was the head of sport at the time at BBC Radio Scotland, asking me, would I be free to take the train from Aberdeen down to Glasgow, stay overnight, and broadcast to the Scottish nation the Kilmarnock-Dumbarton game, which was a commentary game on the radio, the next day. In those days, it was just one match that you got. And this was the game. It turns out that David Francie, who was the regular commentator, was absent because of a knee injury, and all the other replacements were unavailable for whatever reason. So I was asked, would I do this? And of course I said yes, jumped on the train, spent the night in Glasgow, went down to Kilmarnock, did the game the next day. Wasn't that nervous, as I recall, because at 19, I don't think you get nervous in the way that you do perhaps when you're in your 50s, as I am now. And did the game and thought, OK, I've got this under my belt. Let's see where it goes. So I got back to Aberdeen, went in to see my parents, and I got the note from them that said, call Charles Runcie. So I called Charles Runcie, and he said, well done today. Really liked the commentary. Now I've got a question for you. England, Scotland at Wembley this midweek. How do you fancy it?
I mean, I like you saying, you know, I like how you're talking about this in the same tone as though someone's just done a little bit of work experience in the local supermarket and they've been offered a full time job for maybe when they leave university. But you're talking about BBC Scotland and probably the biggest grudge match in world football if you really think about it.
Well, yes, the oldest international fixture that there is. And I think you have to say that back in the 80s, you know, anybody who's, you know, younger listening to this probably thinks England, Scotland, OK, it sounds pretty good. But I mean, that was certainly as Scots, that was the game. That was the game. It was on television live every single year. It meant something back then. Now, it was starting to sort of be less relevant in the sense that this was a midweek game and not a weekend game. So you could sort of see that the trend was there towards the diminishing of this fixture. This was part of the Rouse Cup, as it was called, and then it became more than just Scotland and England, and then it went away altogether, which I think is very sad. Still to this day, I think it's very sad that the oldest international fixture has not played more regularly. But at that time, it was highly significant. And so I went down and I did the game, worked with John Gregg, the former Scotland captain, and actually with Mike Ingham as well, who is a fabulous broadcaster, who many of you will know, who's now retired and I think living in Cornwall very happily. But Mike was the other commentator on the days when you would do 22 and a half minutes each. It was one of these little quirks of BBC Radio for many years and decades that you would have two commentators. One would start it, the other would finish the half, and then the same in the second half, and you'd have a summariser, and it was John Gregg. So, I mean, this was my first trip to Wembley. I'd never been to an England-Scotland game before, not even as a fan. I mean, we lived in Aberdeen. Glasgow was 3 hours away. And my focus as a youngster was probably more on my local team, Aberdeen, than it was on the national team, although I cared passionately about Scotland doing well and followed them, of course, on television at every major tournament back when they were qualifying for the World Cup pretty much all the time. So did the game, and again, I think it went pretty well. And, you know, I could take you through the football side of it, but for me, it was all a bit of a blur because you're focusing on the commentary. You're focusing on your part of it. And, you know, I was introduced to all the grandees, all the greats of Radio 2 at the time, Peter Jones, the late Peter Jones, Brian Butler, the football correspondent, Ron Greenwood, who was, of course, the former England manager and was working for BBC Radio at the time. And again, I was just sort of trying to worry about my little part of it. But, you know, again, I was pinching myself because here I was in the main press box at Wembley looking down at the action, and it was all there in front of me. And, you know, you said it's a bit like somebody who's only had a bit of work experience getting the big job. It was somebody at Radio Scotland. It was actually a guy called Stan Taylor, who was the head of Radio Scotland, who came up with, I think, the best line of all on that front. He said, it's a bit like, you know, somebody who's in the chorus line, you know, getting the big part as the lead voice in a musical production. The difference is, he said, you weren't even in the chorus line until last week.
I mean, that's brilliant. I mean, it is incredible that, you know, it's like, for me, I was thinking about it beforehand, is that, and we'll come on to the game itself and what you remember of the game, but I want to talk about, I'll come on to the analogy I'll give you now, but I want to talk about you then, the build up to this, is that when did you realise that being a commentator was going to be pretty much the be all and end all for you?
I think I realised, it's a funny one, I think I realised much earlier than that. I think when I was covering Aberdeen's games in Europe, the season they won the Cup Winners' Cup, and I was lucky enough to cover all the home games for Hospital Radio, I think at that point, I used to make tapes and I used to listen back to the whole thing. And people used to say, why are you, that's a bit egotistical listening back to the whole thing. But what they didn't realize was I was listening back as my own biggest critic. I was listening back at everything, every word, every inflection, every description of a particular passage of play. And I wanted to be better at it. I wanted to be really good at it. And people said, well, you sound pretty good to me. I said, no, you don't understand. I want to be very, very, very good at this, you know, because to be honest, it's a passion and it comes from the heart. And, you know, obviously I had something in the first place before BBC Scotland gave me that chance at such a young age. But a lot of it is hard work. And I say that to every aspiring broadcaster. You can have the natural ability, and you do have to have that. You have to have a certain sound to your voice. You have to have a work ethic. But it is down to you to take what you've got and put it into practice. So it was probably around the age of 16 or 17, but I was also conscious of the fact that you have to be lucky, that you have to have the break. And, you know, there are so many great broadcasters out there, many of whom I'm very friendly with to this day, you know, who've gone through the same system as I have, you know, who've done it for years and years. But, you know, some have had the break and some haven't. So there's a very fine line. You know, when I say the break, you know, some have got top jobs somewhere. Others have toiled away, maybe in local radio. But often it's down to that break. And as I say, I was fortunate enough to get mine at the age of 19, and it led to me joining the BBC full time. And it was the building block for, you know, what I've gone on to do in the United States, again back in the UK and Germany, and now living in the USA again.
Yeah, I mean, that was the analogy I wanted to use. You think about how many careers have been made because they were able to step in because of injury at such a young age. And because of that, they've then, you know, they've gone on and made careers. And that is literally how it was for you, wasn't it? Because the commentator you replaced, I think reading upright, was actually injured and couldn't travel for the Kilmarnock St. Martin game. And do you like that idea that your career has... It's not from a broadcasting perspective. Obviously, it is because you were good, but there's kind of a football tinge to how you got your break.
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, I think if you go back and read the archives, a guy called Jack Webster, who's also originally from my part of Scotland, the northeast of Scotland, Jack took a real interest in my story, as he tended to do with most stories from the northeast of Scotland. And he, I think in the summary he wrote, he actually wrote it like an injury report. He said, you know, David Francey, knee injury. Jerry McNee, cup tie. Jerry McNee was a commentator and journalist at the time. Cup tied with the newspaper he wrote for, which was the Daily Express, as I recall at the time. Roddy Forsyth, who's a broadcaster still around on the BBC in Scotland. Mexico jaglag, which was true. Roddy had to have all his jags or jabs or whatever you call them ahead of the World Cup. He was going to Mexico for the World Cup and so took himself out of the game. I'm not sure that Roddy should have done that really, but it was because I've had many of those shots or jags and I've been fine after them. But anyway, I'm grateful because it gave me my big chance.
So your initial reaction, and you've been very professional in talking about it, and you've been, I like the way that you've kind of taken it all in your stride. But the football, Derek Ray, the football fan Derek Ray, how did he react? Not the professional, you know, hard working, prepared to the absolute last nth degree. How did the football fan Derek Ray take that news?
I was just in my element. I just was thinking to myself, I'm going to Wembley. You know, I'm going to cover England against Scotland. And in a sense, you know, it's maybe too much too soon because, as I say, at that particular time, it didn't get much bigger. Other than going to the World Cup, there wasn't much bigger for a Scottish football commentator than covering England against Scotland at Wembley. You have to understand that generations of Scots had made that their rite of passage, you know, going to Wembley every 2 years, in some cases cutting up the Wembley turf and saving it as a souvenir in the back garden. 1977, of course, for those with long memories, that was when that happened. Sorry, you were going to say?
No, I was saying, of course, and the other thing I kind of wanted to say before was you were obviously going to the home of the 1967 world champions, as Scotland calls themselves, because they beat the great team of 66.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that was that around that time, there was a very influential documentary series made by BBC Scotland called Only a Game. And it was brilliant. It was of its time, but it sort of told the Scottish football story. And I think people of my age group were very taken with the series. And it really did a wonderful job of vividly retelling the story of 1967 and why that meant so much to Scots. You know, England were the world champions. And in this series, you had people like Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Bobby Robson, Scots and Englishmen talking about how, you know, back then, I think Bobby Robson actually said it. He said, if I had said one country will come to Wembley and beat us within a year of being crowned world champions, I would have said it'll probably be Scotland. And that was how it was back then. And of course, Jim Baxter was the star of the show in 67, playing keepy uppy as only Baxter could do. I think Dennis Law would have preferred that Scotland buried England beneath an avalanche of goals. But it wasn't the Baxter way, and it wasn't necessarily the Scottish way at the time. So it was very sort of, you know, deep-seated and very important to the psyche back then to do well against England. And as I say, it's a bit disappointing looking back because, you know, my first taste of of England-Scotland, when I look back now, it was the beginning of the end of the fixture, and it was diminishing in importance to the point where it just didn't happen anymore. But, you know, in the 60s, I wasn't quite old enough to remember the matches in the 60s, but I do remember the 70s and certainly the early 80s. And it was always, as I said, the event on the calendar for Scottish football fans.
When you first turn up to a game, I mean, I've done, you know, the peak of my own match reporting career was Brazil versus South Korea in the 2012 Olympics, and I was very, very, very honoured to do that. And but you turn up to a game, don't you think? Well, you always hope that the side that you're going to see has its best players out. And looking through the teams, this and again, you say it's very sad that this fixture didn't continue, because that they were two very strong sides, weren't they?
They were, and the big thing is that they were both preparing for the World Cup in Mexico, and England obviously had loftier ambitions than Scotland, although, you know, that was a good Scottish team at the time, and managed by a certain Alex Ferguson, who was the caretaker manager in the aftermath of the very sad death of the great Jock Steen. And, you know, Bobby Robson managed England, and, you know, I was just having a look earlier at the lineups, and you look at the likes of Terry Butcher and Ray Wilkins and, you know, Glenn Hoddle, who scored in that game for England. And then on the Scottish side, you had Graeme Souness, who was the captain. Charlie Nicholas played for Scotland in that game, went off injured in the course of that game, as it turned out. But, you know, both teams had, when you look back, an embarrassment of riches. And it meant something. It really did. It wasn't just a friendly. And when you go to friendlies nowadays, you can really be, you know, bored a lot of the time, because you don't quite know what you're watching, and you've got all these multiple substitutions in the second half. You know, this was competitive, and it meant something. And yes, the World Cup was coming, but neither side wanted to lose to the old enemy.
And what was the game like? I mean, England raced into a bit of a lead, and did Scotland? I remember some games growing up where Scotland, on occasions, would come and blitz England, and on occasions would have a bit of an inferiority complex. What Scotland turned up that night?
It was a slightly subdued Scotland, I thought, early on. It was almost as though some of the players had other things on their minds, which went against the grain of that fixture. And that was maybe what disappointed me. I was quite happy, actually, that Mike Ingham had the microphone for the first 22 and a half minutes, because he got the first two goals, which were both England goals. And that might have sounded better coming from him at that time. But I recall Alan Ruff was in goal for Scotland. Don't think from memory he could have done too much about the goals. Terry Butcher scored the first one. And Glenn Hoddle had the second. And the first one came from a set piece, from a free kick that wasn't cleared away. It was a case of England winning, I think, the second ball and the third ball. And Butcher was there. Terry Butcher, who I was to get to know quite well, because he went on to play for Rangers, to captain Rangers. And I've worked with Terry subsequently in broadcasting over the years quite a bit. And Glenn Hoddle, another one, who's now on BT Sport, where I was for 4 years. So it is a small world that way. But it was 2-0 to England, and it was, you know, deserved 2-0, and Scotland couldn't really get to grips with what was happening. But then things turned around in the second half, and they won a penalty. I think it was disputed at the time as to whether it was inside or outside the box, a Terry Butcher challenge. Charlie Nicholas went down. That's when he got injured. And so it was Graeme Souness who stepped up and scored, you know, for him, quite a rare goal, actually. Didn't score too many times for Scotland. I think that might have been only his fourth. But what I do remember about that is, I remember thinking at the time, as I watched that penalty, I remember sort of almost after the game dreaming about it. You know, when you're a commentator, you often sort of have dreams about the game that's gone by. And sometimes you're a part in it. You hope that you didn't mess it up. But what I do remember about that penalty, and I've seen it many times since, is that it was probably the perfect penalty. If you want to see the unstoppable penalty, have a look at Graeme Souness, 1986 at Wembley, because it was aimed so perfectly, and it was curving away from Peter Shilton, who nevertheless made a decent fist of getting to it. But Graeme Souness did pull one back for Scotland. But that was all they could muster in the end. But for me, it was really just about the occasion. It was about, you know, being able to say I had done it, and I didn't, of course, at that point know where my career was going to go. But I was two games into it, and I had done England-Scotland, and I thought to myself, no matter what else happens, nobody can take this one away from me.
Exactly, and just so you get into minutes 17, 18, 19, you know, Mike's still talking, and you know, I was always a huge fan of Mike Ingham. You get into minute 20, how are you feeling when you start getting to 22 and a half minutes? What was the gut instinct for you?
It's funny, I remember being, again, and it's strange, I remember being quite calm. And maybe that was sort of the inner voice just telling myself to be calm. But again, if I reread Jack Webster's pieces about my work from those days, and he followed me, he went to the Kilmarnock game with me. I think he used the words cool and calculating, which I never thought I actually was. But perhaps at that age, you know, I do have a theory about youth, and I think that when I see young people even now, that they seem, you know, more confident almost than adults. And I think I had spent so much time preparing for when the chance was going to come that I was, you know, naturally quite composed. Certainly there were no butterflies. There was adrenaline, which there still is to this day. I think that, you know, the day you go into it and the adrenaline isn't flowing is the day you might consider, you know, finding another occupation, because you do need to be charged up, but it can be in a controlled way. In fact, it should be in a controlled way. And that's how it was. And I remember Mike Ingham saying midway through the first half, England 2, Scotland 0, after a word from John Gregg, it'll be Derek Ray to take you through to halftime. And, you know, I'd heard those words on countless occasions uttered by other commentators. And I thought, OK, it's my turn. And here we go. Let's make it rock and roll, and let's make it sing. And hopefully I succeeded.
Do you think if you had been nervous, you'd have, if when you heard Mike Ingham say those words, do you think you might have thought, oh, is he? Oh God, I am, yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know. As I say, it's one of these things that I think I'd visualized it in my mind for years. You know, I've always thought commentators, and I certainly, you know, can speak for myself on this, I've always thought commentators are sort of the ultimate dreamers. We're a bit like all aspects in the sense that we go into a game, and maybe I hadn't figured all this out at the age of 19, but maybe subconsciously I had partially. We go into a game thinking about what the story is. You know, what is the story going in? Who are the characters here? What might happen? And, you know, there's always something that happens that you never could have accounted for. I mean, that's just, you know, live sport, live football. But so I think that's part of the control. And I still, you know, take those techniques into every game I do nowadays. So I go into it thinking, it's not just about, you know, people always say to me, you know, oh, do you have your stats done for the game? And I always say, well, I don't really like talking about having my stats done, because for me, it's more my notes with regard to the story. So the stats might be part of that, but it's not a numbers driven game. It's a story game. You know, it's getting the feel, getting the nub of that story and trying to bring that across to the audience. And again, different techniques in radio, because in those days I was all about radio, not television. And I hadn't, you know, done anything in television. So it was all about, you know, the power of description, the power of painting a picture in the listener's mind. And so, yeah, it's, you know, nerves probably should have been there, probably were there, but they were buried so deep inside me that I didn't recognize them. Yeah, my moment goes back to 2005, and I was living and working in the USA at the time, had been for more than a decade, based in the Boston area. And I was working for ESPN, the American sports broadcaster, and they had rights to the UEFA Champions League, not just in the USA, in Canada and the Caribbean, but in many other territories around the world, Africa, Australia, to name two territories. And the Champions League was a big deal in these territories, of course, and in the USA, where it was gaining popularity. 2005, I was told by my bosses, we're going to send you to Istanbul for the final. I was the lead voice of the Champions League. We did the early rounds from our studios in Bristol, Connecticut. And then out we went to Istanbul for the final. And it was Milan and Liverpool. And I was very excited because I probably knew those two teams at the time better than maybe any teams in the world that I commentated on. And I say that because we had rights to Serie A, and I used to do Serie A most weekends. And I would watch English football religiously every weekend, and Liverpool were invariably on. And, of course, I'd covered them right the way through the tournament from the group stage all the way through the dramatic two-legged semi-final meeting with Chelsea. And Milan, for me, were the gold standard. They were the best, most rounded team in Europe at that time. It's funny, as we talk here in 2018, we think of Serie A as almost yesterday's league. But at that point, it still had a certain kind of grandeur and real substance to it. And, of course, Milan were personified by Paolo Maldini, you know, who was captain extraordinaire. And they really were a joy to watch. And Liverpool went in as big underdogs in Istanbul. And the other sort of aspect of this was it wasn't just about the final itself. We went into Istanbul. We were the only broadcasters, I think, from any country around the world who went in almost a week before the game. And part of that was because it was a long flight across the Atlantic, time zone changes, having to fly through the night. And we were going to be presenting programs from the Sultan Ahmet district of Istanbul, this wonderfully exotic city, every day. And we did a show called Press Pass, which I used to host. And so we did this, you know, in the shadow of the Blue Mosque. And it, you know, and I look back at the pictures from 2005, you know, really, as I said, nobody else was doing this. So we felt we were trailblazers. And it was just a fantastic experience to walk out of our little bed and breakfast in the morning along the cobbled streets of Sultan Ahmet district to our studio and broadcast. And that was before the game even got going.
I mean that sounds fantastic. And in terms of the constraints, because there's so much football on now. And, you know, I will have heard you've done a Scottish game. I've heard you've done a Premier League game. I've definitely heard you do Bundesliga. I've heard you do, I've heard you pick up a Scottish under-21s game, I think. But I can't, don't yeah. You know, quote me on that. There's so much football. Do you think, because we've got the chance to do that anymore, do you think the art of actually spending time and presenting the city, presenting the context to a game, do you think we've lost that a little bit in football presentation?
I think that, let me put it this way, I think that in the USA, where I'm talking to you from now, I think there is more of a commitment to that, because I think they feel here that that is important, that that is context, that that is you know, really all about the story of the game. Whereas I think in the UK, we're a bit more blasé about it. We sort of think, right, okay, we've got to fit this into this slot, and then something else is coming on the back of it, and it becomes more about the game. I think there's an assumption that people aren't really interested in this backdrop of Istanbul or any other city. Yeah, I think you might be right. I've always been attracted to that, and I've always felt that the venue is part of the story, and you want to try to convey the feeling that you get as a commentator, as an eyewitness, to the audience. And I think, you know, most commentators, I think, do that intuitively. And you've had other commentators on this show. I think most commentators regard that as part of the craft, if you like. But I think maybe when it comes to the sort of the bigger decision making within television, we've got away from that in the UK anyway. And I'm disappointed if that is the way we're heading.
You talk about the vibe. When we had Jim Proudfoot on, his moment was talking about Ryan Giggs' goal in the 99 semi-final at the Villa Park. And one of the things that he pointed out was he knew Birmingham well. It was in his blood. And he was able to go in the city and do something before the game. And he said he felt a vibe. Is that something that you were able to pick up on in terms of what was coming, what was going to happen in the evening?
Not really, but I had a sense that something extraordinary was going to occur. As I say, it was a unique feeling in Istanbul because it's so far away, really, for everyone, certainly for us, traveling all the way from the east coast of the United States. And then for 4 days, all we heard was the sound of Liverpudlians, the sound of Liverpool fans singing from all corners of the old part of Istanbul. And, you know, they were having an absolute ball. But the Milan fans didn't really turn up until the day of the game itself. And they were a lot more sort of cool about it. And I think that, again, just went down to the fact that at the time, Milan had a certain expectation of what they were going to do. For Liverpool, you know, this was, again, OK, they'd won the UEFA Cup a few years beforehand, beating Alaves in the final. But this was, again, a sort of a taste of what the previous generation of Liverpool fans would have enjoyed back in the 1970s and 1980s. To be at the biggest club match in Europe, to be at the final, and being determined to enjoy it. I remember being on one of the ferries, because Istanbul is all about ferries when you go from the Asian side of the Bosphorus to the European side, back and forth. And I remember wherever we were travelling on ferries, there were just, you know, scores of Liverpool fans. They heard our accents, got talking to us, you know, and asking, you know, do you know of any tickets? Can we get, do you think you could help us get tickets? So there were so many of them had turned up in the hope of getting tickets. And I think most of them in the end got tickets. But that was the big challenge before the game for Liverpool fans. But it's, again, an experience that's hard to describe, because here we were in Istanbul, but the actual stadium, the Atatürk Olympic Stadium, was a good 10, 15 miles away from the city and not really in an urban neighbourhood. It was almost as though, I remember sort of looking in the distance and seeing these Liverpool fans sort of walking across what looked like sand, you know, sort of miles of sand, like walking through the desert almost. It wasn't a desert, but it sort of looked like that, to get to the stadium that wasn't connected to anything. It sort of stood on its own. I know it was unloved by a lot of fans in Turkey, but it was the venue for that night that will go down, and I'm fully convinced of this, will go down as the most dramatic European club final in my own lifetime.
And it's interesting, the game itself. You as a commentator, it's almost thinking that you've had about three games in one, really, because of what happened in the first half, what happened in the second half, then what happens in extra time with Dudek, and then, well, extra time and the penalties, and it's, put it bluntly, Derek, how knackered were you? I mean, the players, forget them, they're paid to do that, they're conditioned to do that, but how knackered were you come the end of the night?
Pretty tired, but at the same time, but I'll tell you this, Barry, I was tired, because you are, after any commentary, it's amazing, you know, how exhausted you are, because you're committing for 90 minutes, maybe in a way that most viewers don't realise. But this had so many things going for it, this final, just from the neutral point of view. But what I would say is that even though I was tired after that final, I was exhilarated. I was absolutely on a high and actually couldn't sleep. I remember we got back when all was said and done. I know we'll probably talk about the actual final in a second, but just to flash forward, we got back to our hotel at around 4 a.m, you know, just after all, making our way through crowds and as I said, 10 or 15 miles away from the city centre. And our flight was about 7 a.m, or having to be at the airport at 7 a.m. So I barely slept. But you're right, it was compartmentalised, this final in Istanbul. You had the first half, AC Milan flying out of the traps, scoring early on. I remember, what I do remember, and this stays with me, Harry Kewell going off, you know, the lesser-spotted Harry Kewell, who was a strange selection by Rafa Benitez, and being replaced early on. And then Milan scoring again and again to make it 3-0. And I remember looking at my notes, just trying to locate where I'd written down what the biggest margin of victory was in a European club final, because it genuinely looked as though it was going to be one of those occasions. It might be 5-6-7-0. Liverpool, you know, looked as though they might be in for a real hammering. They had sort of come back at Milan a bit. I remember just before, I think it was the second goal, Liverpool were threatening and then sort of got suckered. And, you know, Crespo in those days was the master finisher. Kaká was probably as creative as you would see anywhere in the world. You know, Milan looked as though they had their hands on the trophy. It didn't really matter much what Liverpool would do in the second half.
It's and that in itself is that it, as much as you were going out to a worldwide audience, you were going to an English language audience. The likelihood is the majority of your viewers would have certainly had a dog in the fight in terms of being Liverpool supporters or Premier League aficionados. Do you listen back and see were you as equally ecstatic for Milan as you were for Liverpool, or as you talked before in your memory, the story take over in terms of how you did you think you treated the three sets or the two sets of three goals as equally as you could?
I think so, and I hope so, because the thing you've got to remember is that I was talking to a world audience, as you said, but in the USA context, a big Italian-American audience as well. And Milan were a very popular club at that time. I think that there is always, fans often say, oh, you were more excited about that goal than you were about the earlier goal. But of course, it depends when a goal falls in the game. And actually, if you listen back to my words over Steven Gerrard's goal that made it 3-1, it was almost actually sort of as if to say, well, they've pulled one back, probably not going to have any real bearing on the contest. I can't remember exactly what I said at that point. But when the second Liverpool goal went in, that was Vladimir Schmitzer. It was one of those occasions where, as commentators, sometimes we're doing sort of pass to pass to pass to pass. But there are other occasions where you sort of go into a slightly different mode and you find words to match the situation. And again, it's TV, not radio, so you're not talking all the time. But Liverpool, after Gerrard scored to make it 3-1, suddenly believed in themselves. There was a spark that went off, a light that went off in the players, and they sensed that, they could get at Milan. And there were another couple of chances, and I remember just watching the play unfold, and I think my words were something like, no doubt about it, Liverpool are back in this contest. And then I paused, and Schmitzer took aim, found the back of the net, and all I needed to say was, with a vengeance. Vladimir Schmitzer, 3-2, who knows? Something like that. I can't remember exactly what I said. When that went in, I remember thinking to myself, this could be on here. This actually could happen now. And it is amazing how within the course of a game that can change. It went from 3-0, pretty hopeless. Gerrard scored 3-1. I still thought, well, Milan could probably step up another gear, but they didn't. And Liverpool took the initiative, scored that goal, and of course then made it 3-3. Xavi Alonso not scoring from the spot, but able to follow up to make it 3-3. And then, actually, you thought to yourself, they could probably win this in the 90 minutes. But of course they didn't.
And then it comes to the extra time, and it's interesting that a keeper who was very soon discarded and was... It wasn't. I don't think a lot of Liverpool fans prior to that game had a lot of confidence in him. But what is your memory of Dudek's save?
What I remember is just being blown away. I remember thinking that he was sort of defying the laws of physics, watching it. And extra time had been funny because it had been a bit cagier than what we'd seen in the 90 minutes. The two teams had almost sort of said, right, okay, we're both tired here. And it sort of came in little, occasional spurts. But, that save was out of this world from Dudek. And it, stands the test of time. If you go and look back at it now, it still looks as dramatic as it did on that night in Istanbul. And, Dudek, of course, was to go on to really be the hero, to be the person that we still talk about in connection with that final.
Do you think that was the moment that Liverpool had won it? Do you think?
I wasn't entirely sure because, again, I had a lot of respect for Milan. I almost saw Milan as sort of the team in Europe at that time. I just thought everything they did was class personified. I thought the players were that way. Again, this probably came from watching them every week, watching how they did things. I just thought, Ancelotti, I thought everything about them was perfection. And I sort of thought, Liverpool are still the underdogs here, but, it's going to penalties. And, I couldn't get out of my mind. And again, this is, you're always a product of your age. of what you watched growing up, and I couldn't get out of my mind the Liverpool team of, you know, 20 years before, 30 years before. And of course, you think back to, and the one I thought back to was the final against Roma, against another Italian team. And that went to penalties, and they famously, you know, didn't practice penalties. Poor old Stevie Nicol didn't score. Stevie's a friend of mine, and he doesn't like being reminded of that. But Liverpool did it on penalties on that occasion. But I kept thinking of Bruce Grobbelaar, and the phrase that I always associate with Grobbelaar, going back to those days, was the spaghetti-legged Bruce Grobbelaar, yeah. You know? And I use that in commentary, because if you remember Dudek, we got a great shot of Dudek, you know, right across the line, you know, sort of going crazy, really, with his legs. And it turned out later that he had watched videos of Bruce Grobbelaar doing this, and it was a matter of just doing whatever he could to try to put off the Milan players. And so I think, you know, when you go back to that final, and yes, we had six goals, and you had, you know, Maldini early on, you had Crespo, you had Schmitzer, which for me was probably, the most meaningful goal within the 90 minutes, or the 120, there weren't any goals in extra time. But for me, the overriding image is of Dudek trying to put off his opponents and coming up trumps in the penalty shootout. And I think my line at the end, and it, you know, it seems like a simple line, but for me, Liverpool were the big underdogs. And the line was just simply, against all the odds, against all expectations, Liverpool are the club champions of Europe again. And it just, again, it was one of these situations where you react to what you see. And they seem to make a habit of doing everything the hard way, but doing it. And that's what won it for them in the end, was the ability to persevere, to be there until the last, and it was all personified by the unlikely figure of Jerzy Dudek.
Do you when you're watching players come out, because there's another sort of urban myth maybe about the game, is that do you watch for things that players are doing as they're coming out, and how players are on their body language, who's up for it, who's not? The reason I ask is that, I mean, he's a shy and retiring type. Now he's the manager of Milan himself. But it's famously that Gattuso touched the trophy as he went out, didn't he? Do you pay credence to that?
I try and watch for little things like that, yeah. You actually watch for a lot of things as a commentator before the game. And I think most people would tell you that one of the things that we try to identify to begin with are the boot colours. So we'll often have our binoculars with us and gantries, and the boot colours are quite important, because if you're watching from 100 or 120 yards away, as is often the case, and you're trying to separate a couple of players in a crowded penalty area scene, you want to know the boot colours. But in doing that, you often pick up other little things, little conversations that are going on, you know, even things like, you know, who's practicing free kicks, how's he doing with those free kicks? You know, so there are things that you can see before the game. It's amazing how many things you can see before the action actually gets underway.
And does that remain? I mean, you've done lots and lots of games, and does that still remain the most enthralling game you think you've ever done? Or
yeah, for me, absolutely. And I always tell people, I get asked that question a lot, what's the best game you've ever commentated on? And I always say, yeah, Milan-Liverpool 2005 in Istanbul, on all levels. You know, the venue, the long journey I had to make to get there, the drama within the game. I don't think we'll see that. I can't imagine we'll see that in a major final, from 3-0 to 3-3 to extra time. The team that was 3-0 down goes on to win it. I mean, when does that happen in any kind of major final? And this happened in, you know, the biggest club tournament of them all in European terms. So I think it's going to be very hard to top. And I've often said I'd be very surprised if in my lifetime there is a final quite like that. Quite a lot of people, I think, point to 1999 when Manchester United beat Bayern, but I watched that game. I wasn't commentating on it, but I watched that game, and I didn't think it was a particularly good final up until the last few minutes. So I wouldn't put that on the same pedestal as Milan-Liverpool. Okay, you might say I'm biased because I was there, but I try to be objective about it. I think there's a big difference between 3-0, 3-3, penalties, and then the team that looked as though they were down and out goes on to win it. Big difference between that and 1-0 and then scoring twice right at the end. Fair play to Manchester United, fantastic. But Milan, Liverpool, number one.
And just the last point then, is it, was that game worth all those times that you've sat back and listened to all your recordings? Was that, did that make it all worthwhile?
Well, I hope so, because on an occasion like that, you hope that you have the right words in the right places. And you're not doing a commentary for a review the next day, but you nevertheless hope when you listen to it back the next day that it all makes sense, that you didn't overdo it, because that's always, I think, the tendency of us all. I think that sometimes we all overcook it. We over-egg the pudding, you know, put it whatever way you want. And what really is pleasing from my point of view is that so many people in this era of social media, so many Americans who at that time would have been, you know, maybe high school students or at college, so many of them tell me that it was that final in particular that got them hooked on the game. And you have to remember, it's a different audience in the US. It's an audience that's discovered the game in many cases in the last 10 or 15 years. In the UK, it's an established audience. You know, generations have been watching it and will always watch it. But in the US, this was sort of the evolutionary phase of the Champions League. And I was lucky enough to be providing the soundtrack. You know, I was in the right place at the right time for doing that. But when I hear fans saying, you know, yeah, your commentary on that final really enhanced it and didn't subtract from it, then, you know, I'll admit it. It gives me a warm feeling that I've played a very, very small part in making the sport more popular in the US.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did chatting to him. Derek really was a top man, and he's clearly someone who's obviously honed his craft from day one of deciding to become a commentator. And we hope we hear from him a hell of a lot more in the future as well. We hope you enjoyed it, and see you next week. Bye.